Today is Monday, January 16th. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
...of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining...
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial news and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from all around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for our local headlines.
Vancouver has activated its extreme weather response program this week as temperatures hit the sub-zero mark. That means churches, community organizations have opened up to 200 shelter spaces at 9 sites scattered across the city for people desperate to get off the street and sleep in a dry, warm environment. Vancouver Extreme Weather Response Coordinator Irene Jackson said that the spaces have more mats on the floor than beds, but at least they're inside. Jackson activated the cold weather alert on Friday, and it has remained in place since. She believes the alert could carry on into the next week as more snow and cold temperatures are expected. Monday's low is forecast at minus 5 degrees, according to Environment Canada. Jackson did not have numbers available to say how full the shelters were over the weekend, but confirmed no one who was turned away and that 2 backup sites have yet to be called into action. Shelters are also accepting donations for items such as socks, underwear, gloves, and scarves.
The residents of Cortez Island, with the help of environmentalists and activists from the mainland and the media, have been signing a petition to prevent logging company Island Timberlands from logging more than 1,200 hectares of their property that it owns in Cortez Island, on Cortez Island. More than 6,200 people have now signed the petition, and the petition has been delivered to the logging company's office in Nanaimo. For more on this, we go to a report by Gord Kurbis for CTV News.
Good evening. A tiny island that includes some of the last stands of old-growth forest on the BC coast is at risk of being logged. Cortez Island is home to about 1,000 people, also home to a significant share of the land base owned by Island Timberlands. The company is making plans to begin work on the old growth on Cortez, and the plans are being met with strong resistance from islanders. CTV's Gord Kirbis reports.
Protesters gather outside the offices of Island Timberlands in Nanaimo. Although there are only a half dozen of them here today, they say they actually represent nearly 6,000 upset people.
Island Timberlands has showed no willingness or interest so far to have any sort of meaningful dialogue with the community about what that could look like.
They're worried about the logging Timberlands wants to do in a 1,200-hectare tract of land it owns on Cortez Island. They've traveled to the company's head office to deliver a petition asking them to reverse those plans.
They've been very adamant that their plan is to come to Cortez and to practice industrial-scale forestry because that's what they do.
No one from Timberlands would appear on camera to discuss the matter, but a representative of the company did tell CTV News that all provincial and federal legislations would be followed. The company is promising to honor reforestation and protect any fish habitats and water quality. But not everyone is buying those promises.
Darshan Sahota spent a lot of time defending the current practices of Island Timberlands, and I think that we made it clear that those are not acceptable on Cortez Island.
But not everyone on this island of 1,000 is against the plans. Floyd Anderson has lived on Cortez for 20 years. He spent much of that time having to work as a faller off the island, and he's actually hoping to sign on with Timberlands to help them with their efforts.
I think there is going to be logging. There's definitely going to be protest against it. I don't really actually see, resolve isn't a word I would use.
Anderson says logging runs deep in the island's past and is needed to a certain extent to preserve its economic future.
Logging started in like the late 1800s and it's never really stopped. But this like where we are right now was logged, clear cut in the 50s and 60s.
Island Timberland says it has already changed some of their plans following a meeting held with the community in December, and there may be more future changes following upcoming meetings, but that still may not be enough for those living on the island. Gord Kirbis, CTV News, Cortez Island.
Thanks to CTV for that report. For those of you who are not aware of this petition on Cortez Island, the Vancouver Observer interviewed Carrie Saxifrage and Zabora Berman, the co-authors of this petition, right before they handed it to Island Timberlands in Nanaimo. This is what they had to say.
I'm Carrie Saxifrage. I'm an individual acting in my individual capacity, and I co-authored a petition that we put on an online petition site that has gathered over 6,000 signatures, and it asks Island Timberlands to retain all of the remnants of the old growth forests on Cortez Island, to protect the watersheds and the salmonid habitat, to respect the principles of the BC Sensitive Ecosystems Inventory, and to use no clear-cutting methods on the island. And I'm here because I've lived on the island since 1994. And I care about the community and the ecosystems very much.
My name is Sephora Berman. I'm a Cortez Island homeowner as well. And I'm here because I'm concerned about Island Timberland's plans to log on Cortez. Their plans right now are not ecologically responsible. The profits from this logging will not be going to Cortez residents. They actually won't be going to the majority of the profits won't be going to people in BC or even Canadians. This is a foreign-owned company that's coming in to do logging that's opposed by the majority of the community, and we're here today to talk to them about it. But one of the amazing things is when people heard about Carrie's plan to deliver this petition, there started being requests from around the world. Well, can we help? How can we help? And now, today, the petition is being delivered not only here in Nanaimo, but in London.
In London, Sydney, Toronto, Hong Kong, and possibly tomorrow, Dubai.
Ottawa says it will spend $1.28 billion over 10 years to clean up low-level radioactive waste in the Port Hope area east of Toronto. The waste came from radium and uranium refining operations of the former Crown Corporation Eldorado Nuclear and its private sector predecessors from 1933 to 1988. The federal government says about 1.7 million cubic meters of the waste is located at sites in Port Hope and Clarington, about 100 kilometers east of Toronto. The initiative will be carried out as two projects, one for Port Hope and the other for the Clarington site known as Port Granby. Port Hope found itself in the spotlight about 1.5 years ago when an anti-nuclear activist said radioactive waste there was leaking into Lake Ontario and had contaminated beaches and the water. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, which is licensing the two cleanup projects, has said there is no health risk and the town's cancer rates are no higher or lower than other areas.
And now we have a clip from CBC regarding the recent influx of deaths resulting from the intake of the popular party drug, ecstasy.
Another warning today about the party drug ecstasy. In the past few months, more than a dozen people have died after taking it. Today, BC's chief coroner said more of those deaths have been linked to a more dangerous drug. Renee Filipponi explains.
BC's chief coroner has been investigating a string of recent ecstasy deaths. Since August, 18 people have died after taking ecstasy or MDMA. The toxicology results are troubling.
PMMA was present in 5 cases. MDMA was also present, of course, in all of those cases, and they're all still under investigation.
PMMA, or paramethoxymethamphetamine, is a deadly hallucinogen. It's either mixed with an ecstasy tablet or pure PMMA tablets are passed off as ecstasy. Of the 5 dead, 3 were males between the ages of 14 and 37, 2 females between 17 and 22. 3 of the deaths happened in the Lower Mainland and 2 on Vancouver Island.
This is a new substance for us, so we are not very familiar with PMMA until the last week. In fact, as I say, it wasn't something we routinely tested for.
The coroner will now routinely test all ecstasy deaths for the chemical. Drug makers use the chemical because it's cheaper than ecstasy to produce, but it can be deadly. It takes longer to feel the impact of the drug, so users will keep popping pills till they feel high. It's also dangerous when mixed with other substances. But the coroner wants to be clear. 13 other people died in the same period from ecstasy that wasn't laced.
Taking ecstasy is a risky thing to do. There is no known safe dose. And the finding of PMMA really just corroborates what we've always known, that there is no guarantee of purity.
17-year-old Cheryl McCormick died after taking ecstasy just before Christmas. Her parents say to them, it doesn't matter if the drug was tainted. The message is to simply say no to drugs.
Now, Renee, we know police are investigating these deaths. What's the latest on that?
Well, police agencies have pills from the batches that the victims took. They've given some of those pills to Health Canada, and they'll be doing a full chemical analysis so they can determine just how much PMMA were in the individual tablets. In the meantime, police are trying to sort out who made these drugs and where, and if there are any connections between BC and Alberta. Gloria?
Renee, thank you.
Thank you to CBC for that video.
And in campus news, it's that time of year again for that small but extremely motivated minority on campus who really care about student politics. That's right, the AMS elections are up and running again, with campaigning on now and voting set to take place from January 23rd to 27th. There are 36 candidates running for 18 positions, with 3 vying for the top position of president. There are former AMS VP academic Ben Capellacci, co-chair of this year's Student Leadership Conference, Elisa Jane Cohen, and current VP academic Matt Parson. Stay tuned for our interviews with the candidates on Friday and next Monday. Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a... No, we're not going to take a quick break. We're going to have the weather forecast, aren't we?
Brought to you by Phil from the Storm Club.
Oh, thanks, CJ, man. Man, these are exciting times in Vancouver. Did you know that there's a 10-kilometer-long battlefield occurring right above us, right now?
Whoa. How so?
Well, last week around Friday, we saw the cold polar Arctic air mass advance over us, colliding and pushing back the continental Pacific air mass, giving us some snowy action overnight. This week, we're expecting to see the Pacific air mass bounce back. That, in combination with 2 low-pressure systems heading towards us later this week, is going to be epic.
Man, I've been waiting for some exciting news like this. What are we going to expect?
All right. then here's your weekly 7-day long-term weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, 40% chance of some snow showers, high of +1, low of -4. Tuesday, cloudy overcast with a 40% chance of flurries, high of +2, low of -2. Wednesday, heavy snow, high of 0, low of -2. Thursday, we may see some snow, but maybe rain, high of +5, low of +1. Friday is also rain or snow, depending on the upper air conditions, high of +3, low of -1. Saturday, we're expecting to see showers, high of +4, low of -1. Currently, it is 0 degrees Celsius on UBC campus. I'm hanging out here in the sub with CJ, Martin, and Claire. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that really uplifting weather update despite the snow out there. Well, those are your local headlines and weather report. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Tune in to the 10th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a 14-hour cross-Canada live broadcast on housing and homeless issues. Housing is a right.
There's no excuse why there should be homelessness, and there's no excuse why people should be going hungry in the city of Montreal.
The Homelessness Marathon will be broadcast on over 30 campus community radio stations across Canada. Tune into your local station from sundown to sunup from February 22nd to the 23rd, 2012. Or go to ckut.ca/homeless to listen online. For more information or to participate, contact marathon@ckut.ca.
I'm here to make it known that all peoples, especially the street peoples and the homeless peoples, have a right to mass media and do have a right to say whatever they feel is right to get themselves into better living conditions.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-Sember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the national news.
Delegates at the Liberal Convention on the weekend backed a resolution from the party's youth wing calling for the legalization and regulation of marijuana. The resolution says a new Liberal government would legalize marijuana and regulate and tax its production. However, the resolution is not binding, and there's no guarantee the party will ever actually campaign on legalizing pot. PEI MP Wayne Easter was among the 77% of Liberals who voted in favor of legalizing and regulating marijuana at the party's policy convention in Ottawa on the weekend. He said, quote, "The drug laws that we have in Canada are not working, and we are seeing more and more people, young people who may be just experimenting, and they'll have a criminal record, and their lives will be virtually destroyed. What we are talking about is small amounts of marijuana. I think it is where the young generation is at. This strictly came out of the youth. They know what's happening on the ground with young people. They know how their lives can be destroyed," end quote, says Easter. Jacob Hunter, the group policy director for the Vancouver-based Beyond Prohibition Foundation, stated that the move would save millions of taxpayer dollars. Quote, "We're talking about $400 million that is spent every year arresting just about 50,000 people. plus or minus a few thousand people depending on the year, and that's just for possession, end quote. The policy calls for strict penalties for illegal trafficking, grow-ops, and impaired driving.
Jan 10th saw the beginning of the public hearings on the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline project in Kitimat, Northern BC. A highly controversial project last week. We spoke to UBC professor Michael Byers for a more detailed look at the opposition to the project. This week, we'll talk to former CITR reporter Iqbal Ahmed, CITR news director, actually, in a new program or segment we call Hardball with Iqbal. Now, to get a better understanding of the project's support and the controversy surrounding it.
So, hello, Iqbal.
Hey, Martin.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm excellent. Excellent. A roving correspondent from Jackson, I believe, right?
Yep. Well, technically Clinton, Mississippi, but...
Clinton, Mississippi. Well,
wow.
So, kick off the hardball, Iqbal.
All right. So, in this new segment, what I want to do is kind of show the other side of the issue. I listened to the interview with Dr. Byers, and I thought, you know, that was a very anti-Enbridge interview that was done. So I thought I'd, you know, give them a more pro-development side of things.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think are some of the major positives if the Enbridge pipeline goes through?
I think what people need to understand is that how significant this pipeline would be for Canada and the Canadian economy. In the last, I'd say, you know, like 30, 40 years, Canada's become an energy powerhouse in its own right. And this kind of has taken to the next level in that right now, as Stephen Harper said, I believe it's been a month now, that, you know, Canada should not be captive to U.S. oil demands. Because
mm-hmm.
right now, the infrastructure is not in place for Canada to sell significant quantities of oil to anyone other than the United States. So for Canada to diversify its markets and even tap into such a large market in Asia, I mean, people keep saying China, China, China whenever they talk about expanding Enbridge and the tankers, but this opens up the entire Asia market. It opens up Vietnam. I mean, places like Myanmar, people are saying, you know, it's going to see extraordinary growth in the next 20 years, and then we'll be ready to take advantage of these things. So I think for the future of Canadian energy industry and the sector, it has a very significant impact on Canadian economy.
Could have a pretty significant impact on the Canadian economy, but this is essentially an American decision, right?
In what sense?
Well, it's been put before President Obama to make the decision himself, isn't it?
That's Keystone.
Keystone XL pipeline.
You want to pipe in?
Well, we're talking about Enbridge.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we're talking about, just to clarify for anyone who doesn't know, we're talking about the Enbridge pipeline that would take oil sands oil across, it'd be a pipeline that goes from Alberta oil sands across British Columbia to expanded port, the building in Kitimat Bay, northern, which is in northwestern British Columbia.
Right.
And so from there, be able to take tankers across the Pacific Ocean into Asian markets.
Yeah, and what?
But there's also another pipeline on the table right now, which is the Keystone XL pipeline, which is an expansion of an already existing pipeline to take oil from Alberta down into the United States.
Right.
And both of these pipelines could potentially start getting built at around the same time.
Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are still fairly far-off projects. But I feel like that right now the political climate in the United States hasn't really lent itself to the Keystone XL pipeline, especially with the Obama administration,
mm-hmm.
just because so much of his support in his first election was done under the guise of strengthening environmental policy. And many of his own supporters have come out against him for the Keystone XL pipeline. So he's deferred that decision until after the presidential election, so pretty much a sidestep the entire ordeal.
You think it's a legitimate thing to worry about, that if there's a spill on the northern shore, where right now there is no oil tanker traffic in BC,
mm-hmm.
it would start it off, and that could be potentially devastating to the people who live there?
I mean, of course, and that would be a horrible thing to happen. But I think we need to draw comparisons to other pipelines to show the reality of the situation. The first one that would come to mind, if you think of oil spills in that region of North America, you'd think of Exxon Valdez in, I believe it was 1993.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at the Alaskan pipeline that goes from the very top, from Barrow, like the tip top of Alaska, all the way back to Valdez, which is close to British Columbia, there are not significant oil spills that have happened across that stretch. And the only big oil spill that happened was Exxon Valdez. And that, in recent years, has been looked on as a issue of I lost my train of thought. But that's seen as a human error.
But
these pipelines and these tankers, I mean, there are always issues with pipelines, but I feel the people just put them into scale that intrinsically pipelines, sure, they can be dangerous, but they aren't. And the same with oil tankers. They're not just by their very nature dangerous. And another point I would like to bring people's attention to is there's so much attention given to this Enbridge Northern Gateway project, but there's also another pipeline in the works. It's the Kinder Morgan pipeline, which stands to bring oil down to the lower mainland. And there's actually a small pipeline already existing there, so they're expanding that. And that is far more likely to go through as things stand right now. Because, I mean, there's so much public support against the Enbridge pipeline that's kind of stalling.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, in Kinder Morgan, if you read maybe even, I'd say this summer there was a significant incident with Kinder Morgan, but that was kind of overshadowed with Kinder Morgan merging with another company and becoming the world's largest pipeline manufacturer. But and going back to the thing about the Keystone XL pipeline, with the Keystone XL pipeline, it's the recent controversy with the conservative minister calling British Columbia and the opposition to the Enbridge pipeline kind of, radicals will take over the whole.
They want to stall the political process.
Yeah, for the Enbridge pipeline. And I feel that what people have to look at it, not within the vacuum of the Enbridge pipeline, like what the government is doing, and at least what it struck to me as, was kind of a nudge at the Keystone XL pipeline.
How's that?
They're showing that, like, how ready the conservative government is to push for the Enbridge pipeline to hopefully, twist the United States arm into getting the XL pipeline jump-started.
So you think if the Enbridge pipeline gets passed, that it'll pave the way for clear roads for the XL?
Mm-hmm, definitely. Just because right now, as the infrastructure stands, is that Canadian oil has to pretty much go to the United States. There's no infrastructure for it to go overseas, especially not to Asia. And so if we do build these capabilities to send it to Asia, the United States is losing its main import, its main source of oil. I mean, people talk about Middle Eastern, U.S. dishes and Middle Eastern oil. Only, I think, less than 9% of United States oil comes from the Middle East. The majority of it does come from Alberta. So if from the United States standpoint, if this pipeline is built to China, that cuts into this, like, sweet deal they had with Canada where they're the only buyer and the buyer of a first choice.
Mm-hmm.
So if they see this expanded capabilities to send oil to China but the United States capacity to send oil down to their refineries in places like Louisiana is stalling, they're going to want this new pipeline built because it just means more access to them for oil.
What about on the flip side? If we cut the Enbridge pipeline down, do you think that puts a damper on the chances for the XL pipeline? Or is that sort of separated together?
There's a lot of ifs and buts. I think the XL pipeline's more of the controversy of that's more a byproduct of the current political climate in the United States with the election season coming up. And I think if you get rid of the XL, if you get rid of that pipeline, I think it's hard to tell how the United States would react if it wasn't there. But if it is going to the United States, I feel would want to increase their capacity to take in Albertan oil.
Mm-hmm. And just how much, I guess, in a comparative size stance, how much smaller is the Chinese economy from the U.S. economy?
How much smaller?
Yeah.
The Chinese economy is... When you judge economies, you have to look at them in per capita basis.
Yeah.
So if you have a really, a really large economy, but billions and billions of people, it's not going to be all that significant after a point. On a per capita basis, the United States economy is larger, I feel, is definitely larger than the Chinese economy.
Yeah.
But the thing about the Chinese economy is that it is growing far more rapidly. Most econometric trends show that, I think the main date that's kind of been, you know, catching people in the last few years have been 2020 is when Chinese growth will lead them past the U.S. economy in every sense.
In every sense, eh?
I mean, like per capita and real terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and so when economies are growing this rapidly, their demand for energy grows just as rapidly. Hard. And that's where we stand now. That, I mean, China, it's like you want to get on the ground floor with China, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They're growing rapidly, so you want to get in now, so that growth can be pushed by Canadian oil.
So,
and then when they do surpass the United States economy, the manufacturing, even residential energy needs are growing in China too, as they become more domestic and start living less rural areas. And so when they are that big, that infrastructure will already be there. Mm. And that's what China kind of sees right now, is that China needs to set these deals in now while they still can, before the energy demand get too big and they have to, that their position to bargain has become weakened. So right now China is on the up, they have to secure all these energy supplies before they reach the top, so to speak.
So
Canada's in the position where my point is that Canada should take advantage of this opportunity, because it won't always be there.
Mm-hmm. So we have, because, other than the positives of jobs and incoming money, we could possibly shun a major player in the economic landscape.
Of course, and in a business sense, Chinese and Canadian relations haven't been best. And politically, they've been great,
mm-hmm.
but just in economic cooperation, they haven't actually been as good as many people would think. I mean, I think it was like a month ago, there was this editorial in the Globe and Mail talking about the Canadian government needs to make a concerted effort to reach out to China before, you know, it's too late, because you want to make friends with them while you still can, so to speak.
Mm.
And another important thing to bring up is that Canada should give in just due to what the other possibilities are for the rest of the world, it's just that you have to understand that building a pipeline in Canada, bringing jobs and capital into Canada, to build a relationship with China, to bring money flows, capital flows, all that things, either Canada can have it or it can go to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see it in that frame is that China will most likely go to places like Nigeria to get the oil, yeah. Niger Delta, because China is been building incredibly strong mineral and raw material relations with Africa. So, I mean, this has become kind of a conservative catchphrase in the last little while, but it's the idea of ethical oil.
Yeah.
That would you rather have a pipeline built by Canadians, by a first world liberal democracy in which the benefits of such a large project are distributed to people with rights and is done in an environmentally conscious way? Or would you rather have it done in a place like the Niger Delta, where, I mean, with this summer, there's this massive, massive oil spill. I think it was probably one of the largest in African history in the Niger Delta by Shell. I mean, no one hears about it. It's in a little country, and they don't have the same safety regulations. They don't have the same sort of media scrutiny on them.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, not to bring into some sort of xenophobic context, but, like, would you rather give all this money and this future opportunity to a bunch of Wahhabi Muslims, some very conservative Wahhabi Muslims where execution of women is still allowed, like Saudi Arabia, where
they stone
women to death for adultery? Or would you rather give it to a liberal democracy like Canada, in which, you know, women have the right to vote, and these economic activities will be equally distributed amongst many aspects of society, whether in places like Saudi Arabia and Nigeria, it's only in the, you know, the 1%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, those are interesting ideas. We're going to have to let you go, but we know it's
much
all, you have so much more to say. Well, remember it, because it's always
I'll save it for next time.
Thanks, man. We always have a great time playing hardball with Iqbal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Iqbal. Next time we'll talk about the Palestinian attempt to get full state membership at the UN.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's a lost cause.
All right,
later, man.
But next time, more hardball with Iqbal.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care.
Take care.
And those are your national headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for the international news here on CITR. First, we go to a special segment by our reporter Martin Lumlin on the current political landscape in the U.S.
We are but 10 months away from yet another national election south of the border. The first black U.S. President, Barack Obama, will seek re-election to a second term, but just who he'll face off against on the ballot is yet to be determined. Which means the GOP Republican circus is changing gears and hitting the road, and they're bringing the whole posse out for this one. All of our favorite spineless windbags have come out to abuse, accuse, slander, bicker, torture, attack, torment, smear, sully, quibble, and squabble among one another in a desperate hope that they will be the one to successfully surf their opponent's blood, sweat, tears, feces, and secret addictions right into the White House. They're all here, folks. The evangelical gay basher, Little Ricky Santorum.
Our country is based on a moral enterprise. Gay marriage is wrong.
The Big Rick, the Texan half-wit Rick Perry.
Washington has abused the Constitution. You go back to a decade ago with Woodrow Wilson.
The mammoth elephantine newt with endless lung power, Gingrich.
But can we drop a little bit of the pious baloney?
The invisible man, Buddy Romer. Who? That crazy Uncle Ron, the only man in this show who's actually dumb enough to tell us what he thinks.
It's not authorized in the Constitution that we can take money from you and give it to particular countries around the world. To me, foreign aid is taking money from poor people in this country and giving it to rich people in poor countries, and it becomes weapons of war, essentially. No matter how well motivated it is.
Congressman Paul, would you cut aid to Israel?
I would cut all foreign aid. I would treat everybody equally and fairly.
Alas, all candidates must stand in distant awe at the front runner, the leader of the pack, the incredibly hollow-minded human marionette.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Mitt Romney.
And then there's poor John Huntsman, who right up until yesterday seemed like such a respectable candidate.
John Huntsman's moment to shine may have ended with his third place showing in New Hampshire, but Stephen Colbert's surge in South Carolina may be just beginning. Yes, that's right. Stephen Colbert, the eagle-loving, bear-hating conservative satirist, is polling higher than the former ambassador to China in South Carolina, which happens to be the state where Colbert grew up. Public policy polling puts Colbert at 5% support among primary voters, ahead of Huntsman's 4% and former Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer's 1%. The Colbert Report had hoped not only to score naming rights to the southern state's primary, but also to get Colbert's name on the ballot, along with a referendum asking whether corporations are people. He accomplished none of those things, but Colbert's efforts have him on the voters' minds in the open primary. Will he get some write-ins? If he does, Huntsman may be in trouble on January 21st.
Ah, yes. It is a true testament to the American dream and its political mechanism that a hilarious buffoon like Stephen Colbert could chase a former U.S. ambassador right out of the primary race.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what to say. This just got real. A major pollster has me at 5% ahead of the third place finisher in New Hampshire. I gotta ask. What do you think, nation? Should I run for president in South Carolina?
Yeah!
I hear what I'm asking you to say.
As hilarious as Stephen Colbert's potentially sudden arrival on the GOP scene might be, it is not likely that he'll win the nomination. Things aren't looking very hopeful for Rick Santorum either. After a strong showing in Iowa, he faltered badly in New Hampshire, and unless he could pull a miracle out of his bag of religious tricks, he's pretty much toast. Which leaves us with four. It's becoming more and more clear with each passing day that Rick Perry has more money than brains.
And that's the reason my flat tax is the only one of all the folks, these good folks on the stage. It balances the budget in 2020. It does the things to the regulatory climate that has to happen. And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
Five.
Okay, so commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA, there you go. No, okay.
Let's stop getting it.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no
can't,
doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't.
It sounds like education's already been done away with, which is a good thing for Mr. Perry. It's one less thing he'll have to remember. And then there's Newt Gingrich, who seemed to be such a serious contender at the beginning of this contest. But after lukewarm performances in both Iowa and New Hampshire, the Speaker of the House has his back against the ropes, and he is swinging fiercely, particularly towards Mitt Romney.
What has Massachusetts given us? A liberal governor who wanted us to believe he is strong on defense. A liberal senator who wanted us to believe he was a man of the people. And a Massachusetts moderate who runs away from Ronald Reagan.
Look, I was an independent during the time of Reagan Bush. I'm not trying to return to Reagan Bush.
Romney donated to Democrats, and given the choice to vote in the Democrat or Republican primary, Romney chose the Democrats, voting for a liberal Democrat instead of President George H.W. Bush. Romney opposed the Contract with America, raised taxes, and authored government-mandated health care with taxpayer-funded abortions. But now, he tells us, trust me, I'm a conservative. Massachusetts moderate Mitt Romney, he'll say anything to win. Anything. And just like John Kerry,
laissez-les bon temps rouler.
He speaks French, too.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Mitt Romney.
But he's still a Massachusetts moderate, and a Massachusetts moderate cannot beat Barack Obama.
I'm Newt Gingrich, and I approve this message.
The human Newt has already invested more than $3 million in advertising for the South Carolina primary, which is in less than 2 weeks. Now, this is an unheard of amount of money to spend on advertising in a state where airtime comes fairly cheap.
Others seem to be more focused on attacks rather than moving the country forward.
If this expenditure proves to be in vain, I don't think there's any reasonable doubt to say that Newt might not be able to keep up with the two frontrunners. And then there's the walking taboo. A man no one wants to pay any attention to, despite his strong support. There's no doubt at this point that Ron Paul is just barely nipping at Romney's heels. I've never seen or even imagined a major federal politician in North America with more grit than Ron Paul. Whether he's encouraging nuclear development in Iran,
just think of the agitation and the worrying of a country that might get a nuclear weapon someday, and just think of how many nuclear weapons surround Iran. The Chinese are there, the Indians are there, the Pakistanis are there, the Israelis are there, the United States is there, all these countries. China has nuclear weapons. Why wouldn't it be natural that they might want a weapon? There'd be, internationally, they'd be given more respect. Why should we write people off? There was, you know, in the 50s, we at least talked to them. At least our leaders and Reagan talked to the Soviets. What's so terribly bad about this? And people where, countries that you put sanctions on, you are more likely to fight them. I say a policy of peace is free trade. Stay out of their internal business. Don't get involved in these wars. And just bring our troops home.
Congressman Paul, Congressman Paul,
Mr. Cole, I want to just give you 15 seconds. I want to just make sure I understand. So your policy towards Iran is if they want to develop a nuclear weapon, that's their right. No sanctions, no effort to stop them.
No, I think that makes it much worse. Why would that be so strange if the Soviets and the Chinese have nuclear weapons? We tolerated the Soviets. We didn't attack them. And they were a much greater danger. They were the greatest danger to us in our whole history. But you don't go to war against them. I mean, this whole idea of sanctions, all these pretend free traders, they're the ones who put on these trade sanctions. This is why we still don't have trade relationships with Cuba. It's about time we talk to Cuba and stop fighting these wars that are about 30 or 40 years old.
Or plugging the legalization of illicit drugs?
Congressman Paul, you say that the federal government should stay out of people's personal habits. You say marijuana, cocaine, even heroin should be legal if states want to permit it. You feel the same about prostitution and gay marriage. Question, sir, why should social conservatives in South Carolina vote for you for president?
Well, they will if they understand my defense of liberty is the defense of their right to practice their religion and say their prayers where they want and practice their life. If not, you're going to end up with government that's going to tell us what we can eat and drink and whatever. You know, it's amazing that we want freedom to pick the future, you know, our future in a spiritual way, but not when it comes to our personal habits.
Senator, are you suggesting that heroin and prostitution are an exercise of liberty?
Well, you know, I probably never used those words. You put those words someplace. But yes, in essence, if I leave it to the states, it's going to be up to the states. Up until this past century, you know, for over 100 years, they were legal. What you're inferring is, you know what? If we legalize heroin tomorrow, everybody's going to use heroin. How many people here would use heroin if it was legal? I bet nobody would put their hand, oh yeah, I need the government to take care of me. I don't want to use heroin, so I need these laws.
Ron Paul is a unique contender in an arena filled with plagiaristic blowhards. He's an original thinker who's yet to change his stance on any major issue. Sort of like a weird maverick. And then there's the newest link in the Romney dynasty.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Mitt Romney.
By winning the first two states in the primary campaign, Mitt Romney has cemented his place as a GOP frontrunner. And he's got plenty of cash to make it through to the finish line. He's got about $14.5 million of fundraising money left. And things haven't even really started to get serious. He's billed as a social conservative, offers very little in terms of new ideas, and is good with money. In short, Mitt Romney is the ideal Republican candidate, or at least the closest they can drum up this year. If he's able to weather the attacks that are bound to continue against him over the coming months, it's likely he'll emerge with a firm hold on the nomination. But if he falters, this race will be thrown wide open.
Well, and in more American political news, Republican candidate John Huntsman has officially dropped out of the Republican primaries, he announced on Monday afternoon. Huntsman, whose previously hyped campaign failed to gain the traction and funding that it needed with voters in a crowded playing field, called for the party to unite around the candidate best equipped to defeat Obama. He accused candidates of creating toxic discourse, saying that the race has generated into an onslaught of negative and personal attacks. Huntsman had been relying on a strong showing in New Hampshire to continue his campaign, and although he received 16% of the vote, this was not enough to continue. Despite his efforts at a civil campaign based upon his extensive foreign policy experience and conservative background as governor in Utah, many voters failed to sense a clear and consistent message from Huntsman, especially in a field that already contained one Mormon governor, with a more centrist policy in Mitt Romney. In dropping out of the race, Huntsman announced his endorsement of Romney, although this is not expected to make a huge difference in this week's South Carolina primaries, as Huntsman did not have a large support base there.
Last month's devastating typhoon in the Philippines had extreme effects, and these effects continue to resonate. As we begin to fully understand the scale of the disaster, questions are arising as to whether the government could have done more in response. For more, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
Tens of thousands are still recovering from last month's devastating typhoon. Many are grappling with the psychological effects of the disaster and the loss of loved ones. Environmental activists say at least 40 survivors have committed suicide. Some argue the tragedy could have been avoided and blame a weak government and environmental destruction as primary factors. FSRN's Madonna Varola reports.
A father carries the body of a dead child. A mother hugs her dead baby on the street. Children look for their parents. Dead bodies are everywhere. These are among the photos capturing the devastation of Typhoon Washi, collected by environmental activist Orlando Ravanera.
The tragedy did not just stop after December 17, when 1,453 are found dead and about 1,000 more are missing. The pains of the people continues because there are incidents of suicides. What will they do after they have lost so much already? Their loved ones are not there anymore. Or they have committed suicide. Yeah.
For survivors like Marisa Katubig, the scenes of the disaster are still vivid.
So dark, no, because everybody was sleeping.
It was so dark, everybody was sleeping. Waters rushed. We stayed for hours on our roof. This is a first-time experience for all. Lining up during the relief operations was dehumanizing. There was no system in our village. The goods were just being thrown at us.
In the aftermath of the disaster, many donated aid, including some of the Philippines' poorest citizens, who brought clothing and blankets to survivors. Among international assistance, USAID provided $100,000 through the Catholic Relief Services for water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies. But there's growing concern that much of the tragedy and loss of life could have been avoided, says environmentalist Ravanera, who also heads Task Force Makahalar, a coalition of farmers, fisherfolks, and indigenous people and women in southern Philippines.
Since 1991, we have been staging direct actions against logging and against illegal mining, industrial pollution, all kinds of ecological destructive practices. Because for us then, there is no such thing as legal logging. Because the remaining forest from in that area, from some 100,000 of hectares 3 or 4 decades ago, we barely have 2 or 3,000 left, no?
Ravanera is studying the ecosystems of Mindanao. Members of Congress will use his findings in their investigations. One senator, Aquilino Pimentel III, recently initiated a probe into why the disaster happened. Through these investigations, Ravanera hopes the country will learn a valuable lesson.
If only institutions prove to be the vanguard of the environment, and we Filipinos should have been more aware of what has happened, if only the media did its role in exposing all of this, and even if the church has mobilized its own spiritual power to tell the people that protecting God's vanishing creation is really the highest form of worship now.
Government and non-government organizations are now conducting stress debriefings among the survivors at the evacuation centers and schools. Nora Villamiranda is a social worker at the government's Department of Social Welfare and Development.
Yung buhay na yon, parang nandun sila sa extreme poverty.
Many of those affected are in extreme poverty. If they lose their children, who are their treasure, what would be left for them? If their spouse or relatives are killed, where would they go? The government's assistance has limits. We have to help the survivors tell their stories by listening to them.
As hard-hit areas continue to rebuild and activists push for stronger climate and environmental justice policies, some survivors emphasize the importance of mental health services. Teary-eyed, Orlando Ravanera says the country needs more than just material aid.
Because I do believe that, yes, a man can live without food for 40 days, without water for 8 days, without air for 8 minutes, but he cannot live even for 3 seconds without hope, without faith, or without love. And so that is how. What's the reason for living anyway? Everything is lost. We embrace them. We teach them how to sing this time. A boy was singing Impossible Dream while crying, and so many are crying. So how do we now rehabilitate these psychological setback.
Madonna Virola, FSRN, Quezon City, the Philippines.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us a little bit of insight into that Philippine disaster. Those are our international headlines, and in fact, our program for today, January 16th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for So Throats Clapping Hands with Robert right here on CITR 101.9 FM.